My guest today is Professor Alexander Sack, who is Professor and Chair of Applied Cognitive Neuroscience at Maastricht University. He is also co-founder and board member of the Dutch Flemish Brain Stimulation Foundation. Welcome, Alex.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for doing this late in Netherlands. So I have a few of your papers. I want to start with one of the working papers entitled Target Engagement and Brain State in TMS. You say here, transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS, is capable of non-invasively inducing lasting neuroplastic changes when applied repetitively across multiple treatment sessions. In recent years, repetitive TMS has developed into an established evidence-based treatment for various neuropsychiatric disorders, such as depression. You say here, despite significant advancements in our understanding of the mechanisms of action of TMS, there is still much to learn about how these mechanisms relate to the clinical effects observed in patients. Yeah, so I find this a fascinating topic, Alex. So I know nothing about it. But I always thought that the body, the human body or any other body is sort of an electrochemical magnetic system. And when we think about diseases, when we think about interventions on the human body, we 99.99% of that is still chemical. and so I always wondered the electricity and the magnetic part of the body, whether we can use those things to impact something. So here, this is something that is done to the brain, right? So what could you give us sort of an engineering explanation of what TMS is and how it's applied and all of that?
Yes, of course. So TMS stands for transcranial magnetic stimulation. And it's probably at the moment one of the most versatile and well-established brain stimulation techniques that is non-invasive. Many people might know about brain stimulation and consider it always an invasive procedure where you have to go into a hospital and get maybe an implant by surgery into your brain that then stimulates deeper lying structures like in the deep brain stimulation procedures. And this is all true and is also happening, but there's also a number of technologies available now which are completely non-invasive. And that means you don't have to undergo surgery, not even anesthesia. You can be completely conscious and you can receive brain stimulation in such a simple way that you can actually walk into the clinic, have your half an hour brain stimulation treatment, and immediately after go home again without any side effects. And TMS is one of those non-invasive brain stimulation techniques. And they usually start with a T for transcranial, because this is more or less the same meaning as non-invasive, because transcranial literally means it's through the intact skull. Yeah. And there are a number of technologies, and TMS is through the intact skull, transcranially, using magnetic pulses. So what it does from an engineering point of view is very simple. You have a stimulator, which is in essence a bank of capacitor that is capable of producing a very strong electric current.
Yeah.
And electric current is discharged into an electromagnetic coil. There's a bit, has different geometries, different shapes, but it has the size maybe of a shower head.
Yeah.
And this electromagnetic coil is just placed on the outside of your scalp. It's really having contact to your head. Yeah. And then a very strong current runs through this coil. And because it's a moving current, according to the law of physics, you have a magnetic field that is produced. And this magnetic field can pass through any matter, through your bone, through your skull, and it enters into your brain.
Yeah.
It's not a static magnetic field. It's a time-varying magnetic field. So it's a very quick rising magnetic field and then decaying again very quickly. And that's why we call it a pulse, TMS pulse. And because, again, according to the law of electromagnetic induction, the law of physics, if if a secondary coil or any conductive material like the brain is exposed to a magnetic field that is rapidly changing over time, what you get is electromagnetic induction. Yeah. That means you will induce electricity in the brain, an electric field in the brain. And because the brain cells, the neurons, communicate with each other, also with electricity, what you're doing is you make them active, you make them fire, as we say. You're stimulating the brain via magnetic pulses, completely painless and non-invasively, and that's what TMS can do.
Okay. So that is really clear. And so the magnetic external magnetic field introduced to the surface of the brain creates some electric pulses, let's call them, inside the brain. And we know that the brain works through electric signals.
Yes.
And so when you externally apply them, it's going to either sort of impede what was going on or enhance what was going on. It all depends on the phases and all of that, right? So how do you determine where to put the target and what frequency to use and all of that minute details?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. That is the $1 million question, of course. Yeah. And that's why TMS, since it was, let's say, as a technology introduced into the scientific field, that was in 1985, so it's a long time ago. It's not a new technique. And just very recently, let's say in the last 5 to 10 years, it has developed into a tool that we can now use to really treat different disorders like depression. And it's even reimbursed by health insurances. So it took 20 years of fundamental research to answer all the questions that you just asked before we could really bring it to the patient in a safe and effective way. So what you need, for example, if you want to use it as a treatment for depression, you need to first have a model, a brain model of the underlying pathophysiology of depression. You need to do imaging studies. You need to do a lot of groundbreaking research to understand which areas of the brain are pathologically altered in a certain state of clinical depression. And we have ideas about this. We have networks, different networks identified in the brain that we believe are affected in a clinical depression. And then we use the technology of TMS to target, for example, based on individual fMRI data, to then target one knot of this network with our TMS stimulation. And by doing so, we have seen, and also in our research, that the effects that you have on this depression network is not restricted to the area that you target, but actually what you do is you put energy into one knot of a highly connected network, and this energy that you put into one brain area will propagate through this entire network, affecting many areas that are part of the same network that you want to modulate. Yeah. So that is the attempt to identify where do I have to put my TMS coil on the head in order to stimulate a certain brain region that is connected to a network that I want to modulate. The next question is what parameter? We have at least two other parameters that we have looked into in the last 20 years. One is the intensity. You need to calibrate the intensity of the stimulation, similar to like you have to dose the medication if you take drugs for a particular disorder. Also there's some dosing and calibration based on the individual parameters taking place, and the same in TMS. And we have certain technical procedures for this to identify which magnetic field strength is needed in this patient in order to have a response on the brain.
Yeah.
And then we use this to have an individual dosing of intensity. And the last important parameter to mention here to address your questions is indeed the frequency with which we stimulate.
Right.
Because the frequency of the pulses measured in hertz, so and it can vary between 1 to 100 hertz in modern TMS technologies, meaning that you either give one pulse per second in the case of a 1 hertz protocol, or 20 pulses per second in case of a 20 hertz RTMS protocol. And we do that repetitively, and that's called RTMS then. These treatments are usually RTMS treatments, for standing for repetitive TMS. And only this repetitive TMS, again, based on knowledge that we have from a neuroscience in neurophysiological studies, we know that by doing so, the brain being exposed to a series of repetitive stimulation with a particular rhythm, this will lead to changes, functional and structural changes on the synapses, which is the connection between neurons, where the information, the signal gets transmitted to the next neurons within a network. You can actually change on the synapse level, the transmission efficiency. So you can actually make a connection stronger or weaker, depending on the frequency with which you stimulate.
Right.
And we do both depending on what we want to achieve. So if you have a disorder like depression, where you have identified through fundamental neuroscientific research that the problem lies in a network being not strongly connected enough, or two, is characterized by not being active enough, you will use a particular frequency to actually counter this problem by increasing the activity level, by increasing the connectivity. And if you have a disease where the problem, like in epilepsy or in neuropathic pain or in other disorders, why the problem is actually that you might have a pathological hyperactivity that is not beneficial, or a connectivity that is maladaptive and leads to negative symptoms, you can use a different frequency that will actually, over a number of sessions, reduce the excitability and reduce the connectivity. And this has all been established in not only in models, but also in vivo and even in vitro studies that we've done in neurons in a cell dish, where you stimulate with these frequency and you look really on the cell level what is happening in terms of plasticity, as we call it.
Yes, TMS. I was wondering, Alex, that it is truly a network effect, and we know that the brain is a very complex organism, potentially with a lot of redundancy in there. I don't know much about the brain, but I was wondering if there is some sort of network load balancing algorithm or agent running there that might have multiple sites where the signals could be directed to, depending on availability and load. And so, and you talk about here, so the observation that the effects are state dependent is very important, right? So, so am I thinking about it the right way, that we don't necessarily have a deterministic view as to how the signals will be routed to another location? We have some potentially some probabilistic understanding how that will happen, right?
That's correct. That is what the article that you referred to is something that we described there in great detail, because everything I said so far seems very deterministic indeed. So you had certain frequency that will do this, and another frequency will do the opposite, and then you place it there and period. And then you can be sure that you either increase activity or decrease activity in a patient as you desire as a clinical treatment. But that is not the case. The reality is indeed that depending on the state of the brain at the moment of the stimulation, the effects might differ qualitatively and also quantitatively. And that's what we mean with state dependence. In other words, if I would stimulate your brain while you're fully awake and cognitively engaged in an interesting discussion, for example, with me at this moment, and I use the same physical parameters, everything is identical from a physical point of view, the effects in your brain would be completely different compared to the same stimulation given to you when you are asleep. Which is a very extreme example of a different brain state. But also more subtle nuances in different brain states, what kind of engagement, what kind of task you engaged in, whether you are tired or not. All those are effects that determine the effects of your pain stimulation on the brain. And it is because what happens as a net effect of your stimulation is an interaction between the externally applied magnetic pulses and the internal state of your brain, because your brain is never passive and waiting to be stimulated. It's constantly active. Part of the brain is constantly active with spontaneous firing rates of the neurons. And this is always then an interaction between these two manipulations that lead to the actual effect on the brain. So we need to know about this if we want to be able to predict what we will induce in the brain using our technologies.
So given that variance, Alex, across models, every human being is slightly different from the other. Uh-huh. Across a singular model, based on the state of that model. So given uh-huh. that variance, do we have any control over what we expect to see when we do TMS?
Yes, to a certain extent, yes. But it's one of the hottest topics at the moment to address this variability that we see between patients and to somehow have a control over it by having a better understanding of that state dependency and this variability. And one approach, for example, could be to do so-called closed loop stimulations. So that you just blindly stimulate based on an assumption that is based on from a different brain, and you translate it to somebody else's brain. But while you're stimulating, you're also measuring the effects on the brain. And in a loop, the online real-time assessment of the brain activity is actually triggering the brain stimulation itself. And these are so-called closed-loop systems.
So that is a measurement is by fMRI or...?
By EEG, for example.
By EEG, okay.
Yeah.
And so there is some, so there's a feedback mechanism that is measured real time.
Yes.
Then if you have an automated system, it can basically change parameters to get more effective. And I would imagine there's some machine learning applications here too, right? In a singular model.
Exactly. You're spot on. This is exactly what the field is moving on, moving in this direction. Exactly. It's trying to do these closed loop applications and using, because the parameter space is in principle, of course, infinite, and what you need is exactly the strength. There is if you have a lot of data from brain recordings, for example, you can personalize the brain stimulation parameters using machine learning algorithms to optimize all sorts of stimulation frequency, maybe frequencies or features of the stimulation that we have not yet even thought of. I talked about frequency intensity, but there are so many other parameters that could be important and that we don't know about. And that is the strength of machine learning or data-driven approaches, that they come up with new features that are capable of predicting or optimizing your stimulation effects on the brain and reducing the variability that we see.
Yeah, and there is obviously timing of intervention. There is repetition of intervention. There are so many different parameters that you could potentially vary to optimize the problem, right? So I want to go into another paper that you have, Alex. So repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation treatment for depressive disorders.
Yeah.
Current knowledge and future directions. Depression is a very interesting, disease. We haven't been very successful with chemical agents. It has so many different side effects and all sorts of things. And so where are we on this particular modality? Are we making progress?
Yeah, I would say very much, to be honest. And you're fully right again that depression is I think when it comes to psychiatric or neuropsychiatric disorders, it's by far the most prevalent one. There's an approximation of 300 million people worldwide suffering from depression, and the numbers are actually increasing in recent years. So it's like a pandemic. This disorder, and as you said rightfully, until recently, honestly, we thought, based on the many trials and studies we have with pharmacotherapy, which is still the first line of treatment in many countries, including my own country, and I think also the US. So most treatments include drugs, antidepressants. Yeah. And there was always this understanding in the scientific world that the success of having antidepressants, if we ignore the side effects and the dependency problems for the sake of the argument for a moment, but at least it's effective in approximately 60-65% of patients. That was the benchmark that we worked with. And based on this, we still said that 65% seems like a lot, but that still means that 35% of patients are so-called non-responders, treatment-resistant patients. And that is a lot in terms of a number of patients.
Yeah.
But the situation is likely even much worse than this, because I think just a few weeks ago, a reanalysis of this original data set was published, because apparently the original paper had some statistical irregularities in there. And based on this proper statistical analysis of the actual data, it seems that the remission rates, so how successful are those medications, is more in the vicinity of 30-40% of right. patients responding. Yeah. So the majority of patients are actually not responding to medications. So there is a big need for alternatives. And when it comes to neuromodulation, especially non-invasive neuromodulation, after 20 years of research, it's not a research question anymore. It's quite well established in several randomized clinical trials worldwide that TMS can be used to effectively treat depression in treatment-resistant patients. So because of some regulatory restrictions and the study designs in the early days, TMS was tested mainly on those patients that did not respond to the first line of treatment, which is medications.
Yeah, yeah.
So we had to see whether we can still offer something for those patients that did not respond to any available treatments. They tried often several drugs. You know, if one medication failed, you can move to a different medication or change the dosage and so forth. And only if after often an odyssey of those patients of success, unsuccessful trials with medications, and being finally diagnosed as treatment resistant. These are the patients that were included in those early clinical trials using TMS, transcranial brain stimulation, as a potential therapy.
Yes.
And we know now. Yes.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt. So when there are, yeah, the first line therapies, as we call them, don't work, that is when the therapy is currently deployed. But I think you're arguing that the classification of chemical agents and psychotherapy as first line therapies might need to be challenged as we get more information. But I have a question on that. So do we see side effects of TMS? And the related question would be, are there any possibilities of some sort of tolerance? You know, I know nothing about the brain. I'm just wondering, you know, if you do this quite often, let's say, is there a possibility that the neurons sort of get lazy, so to speak, that it expects the stimulation to arrive at some point?
That's a very good question. Just to finish my thought before, When it comes to TMS being as a treatment for treatment-resistant patient, when you offer TMS treatment for depression, it usually means like a couple of weeks, depending on the protocol of TMS therapy, we see response and remission rates around 50-60%.
Yeah.
I'm talking about 50-60% of patients that get into full remission, so they're fully cured from their clinical depression.
For a period of time, right? For a period of time.
Sorry?
For a period of time, though, right?
Yes.
Typically relapse after,
Exactly, that's right. But that's true with every kind of therapy, that if you discontinue it, because depression is, in most of the patients, a chronic disease, there's always the risk of a new episode or relapse into a new episode. And that's also true for TMS. But it's 40-50% response and remission of treatment-resistant patients. And that's why it's now in the U.S. and many European countries, it's an FDA-approved, fully regulated, proven effective treatment that is also in many countries reimbursed by health insurance. So that is one of the nicest examples of neuroscience-based research that took 20 years and was really, you know, grounded in fundamental research that made all its way to a new therapy that helps thousands of patients now worldwide as an alternative to pharmacotherapy.
Yeah.
Side effects, you asked about side effects. It's very difficult to say. I mean, there are no, there are a couple of side effects that are normally reported. Tiredness, sometimes headache. Most of those have been related to, let's say, the procedure itself, the kind of position in which you are with your head in, you know, with a coil on your head for half an hour of stimulation that can sometimes lead to some muscle stiffness and those kind of things. But we haven't really, after now almost 30 years of TMS, seen any major side effects or long-term negative effects. This is not reported yet in the literature. So the risk profile and the side effect profile of this non-invasive brain stimulation techniques is actually rather positive. The other question, whether you can get some sort of habituation or so, is very, very interesting. Not that I know of, but I think what we sometimes see, and we cannot really explain it, that a patient that was responding perfectly to a certain protocol is in remission and has a relapse maybe 1 year or 2 years later and comes back to our clinic, and you try the same protocol again and then it doesn't work anymore. That can happen. It happens to the minority of patients. The majority usually respond to the same protocol again, but like 20% of patients don't respond anymore. And we don't know why, whether then some sort of change or dynamic in the brain has happened that makes this particular protocol less effective. What we can then do and are often also successful is to change the protocol. And there are different protocols that are now established and recognized to be effective. But it's a bit, this is, I think, the bit bottleneck still, that we know that we have different protocols available that can work.
Yeah.
But we don't have a biomarker or really mechanistic understanding and prediction in the given patient which protocol would be most suitable. It's a bit trial and error at the moment, which is
But it's fascinating. So it is non-invasive intervention.
Yeah.
And if you compute the therapeutic index, efficacy over toxicity, the side effects appear to be pretty small.
Yeah.
And efficacy appears to be higher than what is generally available. So the therapeutic index is substantially higher in this case. Mm-hmm. The problem, I guess, you know, this goes into sort of how do you design these things, looking at the variability. That is sort of the fundamental question, right? So can we get into some sort of personalized medicine? Can we use artificial intelligence to really understand that particular model's brain and really fine-tune all the parameters? So when they go into the clinic, they're getting sort of a machine learning based optimization program that could substantially improve outcomes, I would think, right?
Yes. I mean, that's exactly right. But the interesting thing is that, you know, now that there's so much we still don't know about the brain, you know, and, yeah. and of course the way I describe it here is to explain the situation also that we have ideas about depression and what is wrong in the brain when you have depression and how brain stimulation works and that is so successful. And these are all the good things about this this amazing example of neuroscience driven innovation that actually comes to the clinic. But on all these steps, there's actually so many things we don't know yet.
Yeah.
So it would be a lie to say that we understand what's wrong in depression in the brain. We have certain ideas and hypotheses, and sometimes they turn out to be wrong, you know. So we are far away from really understanding the pathophysiology of depression. And we are also far away to really understand why the brain stimulation works, as how it works and has these clinical effects. So there's a lot of work still to be done, and there might be also things that we do very wrong at the moment because we don't know better. So in this sense, you are right. And this is actually how the research also is developing, that you're trying to always fill the gaps of knowledge constantly. And there you need actually highly sophisticated research infrastructures. An fMRI scanner is very expensive. To do the analysis is very difficult. To include artificial intelligence is also not something that a clinician could easily do, you know? Right. So you have all that high tech expensive research work that needs to be done in a university or a research institute on the one hand, but on the other hand you have already patients that are in need of a solution, and it's already offered as a therapy in private practices, in small private practices by clinical psychologists and psychiatrists worldwide that have the technology in their private practice, and they're already successfully treating patients. Yeah. So what I experience is that I'm in that dilemma of maybe want to propagate a super personalized, closed loop, fMRI guided approach because I can still, you know, fine tune the efficacy by a few percent and reduce variability by a certain amount. But at the same time, I would also decrease the accessibility and the cost effectiveness of this treatment for many, many, many patients.
Yeah, but it could be sort of, so automation could bring the cost down potentially. This is not just a prediction problem from a, I'm biased about this, so supervised machine learning. It's not a prediction. It is a prediction problem, but it's also an unsupervised machine learning problem in the sense that you get a lot of fMRI images and there's sort of a pattern finding question there as well. So can machines find the patterns and utilize that data to fine tune the closed loop mechanism? If that thing is automated, then the cost could be substantially lower, right? I mean, it's a human that's most expensive typically.
Yes, that's true. But if, for example, the fMRI is very limited also in what it can provide. It might be a very good machine to give you whole brain coverage with a high spatial resolution, which networks are involved. But it is very, very limited in providing you with let's say temporal information, the temporal structure of the firing rate of the brain, which could be also very, very important. So then you need to add another technology, like for example EEG or MEGs, to give you information about the rhythms of brain activity over time in the millisecond range, something that the fMRI cannot do. So you need to combine all of this. And then you have a lot of, if you want to have a machine learning automation, then you need to first teach the models and provide all this data. And I think this is something that is at the moment a big challenge, especially in the context of disorders. I mean, you have the situation that you still try to understand how the brain works in a healthy context, right? Yeah. And we're far away from understanding this. And then you have to translate this to a diseased brain that is suffering from particular psychiatric or neurological disorder. And even if you make it to that point, I wonder if the automation would mean that you then, for every patient that you want to treat, you would not need to record this data anymore. You could just use the parameters that you optimized based on a certain data set, or whether you would also, for every new patient, would have to go through the entire recording to personalize this. And that would make it extremely inaccessible and expensive therapy. So there's a bit the balance that you need to find. If you have something that already works for 60% of the people as it is now, very accessible, how much do you want to add in terms of complexity to make it maybe 80% effective, but then make it only available for 5-6 countries in the world that have the infrastructure to do this?
I mean, the thing that is going for it is the incidence rates. You know, the world is spending $8 trillion in healthcare costs. Yeah. And given the incidence rates, this is a very measurable, substantial chunk of that cost. It's obviously not the highest, but it's pretty measurable and big. And so there is money there in terms of cost. If you can come up with something that is really useful. Yes. I want to go into another paper that you have. I find this really fascinating, Alex. So using remotely supervised at-home TES for enhancing mental resilience. I can see some problems here as well. Is there a possibility that people can get addicted to TES if they start to administer it on themselves?
Probably yes, I would say. I mean, again, there's no clear data on this, but I'm not an expert in addiction or this, you know, but I think psychologically you can get addicted to almost everything. So if you have a procedure and you have something they can do at home at your own pace, and you could stimulate your brain, and it induces effects in your brain that releases, you know, neurotransmitters and gives you a good feeling, then potentially you can also be having a craving for brain stimulation in theory. It's not described, but it's possible. That's why I think it should not be the case that people can use it as they wish. It shouldn't be a toy that somebody has at home and uses as often as he or she desires. My paper was describing a situation where, and that's related to what I said before, right? So we have now this TMS technology and fMRI guided TMS. We do all of this, but we have a bottleneck. I see already in many clinics that offer depression or OCD or pain therapy using brain stimulation, we have waiting lists. So there's a bottleneck of the infrastructure and the clinicians that can offer those treatments. The demand is much higher than the amount of systems and clinics specialized in offering non-invasive brain stimulation. And in that context, I was wondering whether, similar to pharmacotherapy, instead of having patients coming to a clinic, traveling there to get the therapy there, is there a way to also bring the therapy into their home environment, remotely supervised? And this is a different technology. It's similar to TMS in the sense that it's also non-invasive, and it also can induce changes on a synaptic level that are outlasting the stimulation. But it uses very low intensity electric current that has even less side effects, and it's very, very safe to be done. And there are certain protocols that also have positive effects on depression. And the idea was to use this technology then as a wearable, smart wireless device controlled via your smartphone in your home environment. But the protocol itself, how often you use it and with which parameters, personalized or not, this cannot be under your control. This must be under the control of a clinician that remotely sets that via the cloud, for example, can program the device that it can only be used following this protocol, and has data that the clinician has access to, data that shows compliance to the protocol, and can still have regular consults with the patient to monitor the progress of that therapy. Yeah. And that's the idea of that remotely supervised TES therapy.
I don't know if you want to go here, Alex. So I was just thinking that one could imagine a device that is measuring signals on the brain, making decisions as to issues that it's seeing, some sort of AI agent, and then in a controllable way, apply stimulation to the areas that may require stimulation. So in essence, you're walking around with a helmet-like device that is basically keeping your brain sort of working as expected.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And people are working and thinking along those lines, of course, always in a clinical context. Think about epilepsy. You could think of a device that is that you are wearing or that's implanted under your skin or so that measures your brain activity and is capable using machine learning to predict a seizure a few minutes, seconds before it occurs, and then triggers a stimulation to avoid the seizure from developing. That is a bit an example of what you just described, but the clinical means and in a way of also a closed loop system. And of course, you can think of something like that in the context of addiction craving. You know, if you have alcohol or nicotine craving, you could this could be detected. Because obviously those cravings, those urges, those cognitive control mechanisms have a signature in the brain, so they could be detected. And there could be a neuromodulation device immediately acting upon this to help to support you in fighting this this disorder.
And also hunger and satiation. So I mean, one of the biggest issues we have in the general public is the weight gain problem. And related metabolic diseases. And really the brain is sort of controlling when you eat, how much you eat, when you get satisfied, all of that stuff. So there could be, so this is what I want to ask you more generally. So if you think about direct CNS diseases like depression, epilepsy, things like that, pain, but are there applications here that are related to general diseases? I mean, brain is a mediator of a lot of diseases in the body, not just in the CNS system.
In principle, yes. Yeah. In principle, yes. Because as you said, I mean, the brain is obviously controlling all of our perceptions, emotions, cognitions, behavior, urges, and so forth. And, but it's also the source of releasing hormones. So it is the main executive control that is probably involved in many also non-classically CNS-related disorders. What I'm more thinking of when... now that we talked about it, we also have to be a bit careful, I feel. I mean, scientifically, this is all very interesting, you know, like we talked about this, that you can have a device that measures brain signal changes and picks up like very, like before you report it, picks up on you having the urge to eat something or the urge to have a drink or is detecting a slight decrease in your mood or in other cognitive abilities that is related to a new depressive episode. So something that is monitoring you on a brain level and then immediately acts on it by directly stimulating your brain. But it's also dangerous. It's also dangerous because where do you draw the line? You know, so and is that something that we want as a society, that everybody walks around with a you know, the brain device that constantly monitors and tracks your thoughts or your you know pathologies emerging and immediately triggers an electromagnetic counterattack, you know, to keep you then we have a huge ethical debate also, what is normal behavior, what is abnormal behavior, and so forth. And then people might use it as a doping for all sorts of, you know, within the health range. So what we shouldn't underestimate that all of the things that we discuss can in principle also be achieved with the behavioral interventions, right? In the end, you can also change your brain by training, by changing your cognitive biases, you know, psychotherapy. These are also very effective treatments. And often those are the ones that are not characterized by a quick relapse, because you're actually working on yourself. And it's not just a psychological mental thing that I'm talking about. Everything that you do, if you learn something new, if you have a different bias or cognitive pattern, how you interpret things or your environment, this actually can be measured in changes in your brain. It's the same thing, but it's a more an intrinsic, you know, changing your behavior. And I think this is something that should be still the standard, unless you can't do this. So for me, everything I talked about, this neurostimulation, is more a means to support this in case you cannot do it yourself anymore. You are clinically depressed and even talking is not possible anymore. Then it's, or epilepsy, these things, you know, you cannot, or within a very limited range, you have control over a seizure occurring or not. It's just a physiological overexcitability, you know, it's hard to control. And then in these contexts, things make sense. But if we strive to modulate all of our behavior at the source only, we're also running into a potentially very dangerous situation where we all end up being zombies. We need to also identify what
I don't know if it is avoidable, Alex. It might be sort of a natural outcome ultimately. I don't know. I'm being a bit pessimistic. But I want to finish up with a policy question it's one of your papers. So European reclassification of non-invasive brain stimulation as class 3 medical device, a call to action. So class 3 it is sort of a very much higher requirement in terms of applications, the cost will go up and all of that, right? So what are the implications for Europe with this reclassification?
I think it's a disaster. I mean, nobody really understands what are the implications. We are all a bit under shock in Europe, especially the researchers, but also the manufacturers and everything. It was definitely very uncalled for. But for some reason, the European Union decided very recently to publish a statement where they concluded, and scientifically that is it is simply wrong. They concluded that recent evidence suggests that non-invasive brain stimulation techniques, such as TMS and TES, the ones we talked about, are much more dangerous than previously thought. And they have to, of course, back up this claim with scientific evidence, and they give a couple of papers, but of course the scientific community that is very, very much expert on these questions all agree that the articles that they presented are completely unrelated to that claim, and that the actual scientific evidence of the last 20 years is drawing the opposite picture. It seems that TMS and TES are less dangerous than previously thought. The number of potential seizures being induced by stimulating the brain is much less than we thought, and so forth. So it's actually not the case what they claim. And based on that claim, they also argue for reclassification of those devices in different classes. And here another confusion occurred. Even though they argued that the technology itself is not as safe as previously thought, they make a difference between the technology being used in the context of a medical purpose, for example, a device that is certified to be a treatment for depression. In this case, so if the device has a clear medical purpose, a treatment for depression, for example, then it's class 2A. Whereas if the device doesn't have such a clear clinical purpose, for example, a device that you want to use in a research lab because you want to try what we talked about, all the parameters, you want to do fundamental research, then you don't use the device for depression, you use it for research in the context of many questions. Then all of a sudden it becomes a medical class 3 device. And as you said, medical class 3 is the highest class you can get. So these are the most dangerous devices available, let's say.
Yeah.
And this makes absolutely no sense if you know those devices. It makes no sense for two reasons. First of all, the scientific evidence that they are not safe is not there. The opposite is true. And second, if it was true, you know, let's go with the European Union and assume they are right and it's dangerous, then dangerous means dangerous, and then it cannot differ if you use it for a particular medical purpose or not. This introduction into medical purpose or non-medical purpose being different classes is confusing the entire community. And at the moment, many research labs cannot continue their research because their ethical committees are very, very concerned. So it's a completely unpleasant situation for the entire community.
Yeah, so I know that you have to go. So, I mean, clearly there are a lot of factors here. The pharmaceutical industry makes a lot of money from CNS drugs.
Yeah.
Any alternatives creeping into that that system is not really welcome. And so there may be, you know, a lot of political factors here. I'm just speculating. I don't know.
Yeah, I also don't know, but I wouldn't rule it out indeed.
Yeah, yeah. And anything that impedes research, by definition, is going to have a negative effect. So
yes.
if research institutions cannot do something because it's now classified as, you know, class three, I think it has long-term negative effects on the idea. So excellent.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks for doing this so late in Netherlands, and really appreciate the time that you spend with me.
It was really my pleasure, and thank you very much for having me and having this interesting discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.